Welcome to Lynn Cullen Live, talk radio without the static. Email your questions and comments to lynncullenshow@gmail.com. And now your host, Lynn Cullen.
Hello there. How you doing? Welcome to the show. Day before Valentine's Day, like I care. And it's a Tuesday, so Susan, hi.
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 I'm looking at poster board thing with a grid on it. And it's got, well, it's filled in with people's initials. I mentioned this yesterday. I was at I watched the Super Bowl with friends at their house. And they had this thing where you're supposed to, for a dollar a square, you're supposed to put in, you know, your initials. And I didn't understand any of this. And you were betting on what the score would be for the first quarter, the second quarter, third quarter, and the final. Okay?
Right.
And I said,
not the color of the Gatorade?
No, it was none of that stuff. So I'm looking at this thing now and I still don't understand it. I said, I don't gamble. I'm not interested. Forget it. Anyway, I was considered to be a wet blanket and somebody said, here's $5. Go put, fill five things in. And I was too lazy to get up. So I said, you fill them in and keep the change. So someone went over and put my initials.
And you won?
They brought this thing over to the house last night. I won three of the four possibles. I won, I'm stunned by this. I won the second, I won the halftime score, the third quarter score, and the final.
How much money did you win?
I think $40.
Well, you better give it back to the guy that picked it.
No, we did. We did. We split it, actually. I thought I left at the half, and I knew I'd won the one, the halftime thing, and I left. And I said, keep it. I don't want it. And I'd gone home. What I didn't know is that I could.
You won two more.
After I left, I can't believe it. I never win anything. Jeez. And in fact, I had nothing to do with that.
You had nothing to do with it, which is why you won.
I guess so. I think it must have been. So I, I wake up in the morning and I start reading. And for some reason this morning, I couldn't take it.
I turned on the television news, and the talking heads were all saying they were so depressed they could barely breathe.
Okay,
and I thought,
right.
Oh, no. I mean, this must be what we sound like. Don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what, how the hell are we going to make it through?
No, because, and I got to tell you, people are calling me up like I supposedly know something, and saying, tell me that we're going to be okay. I said, I can't tell you that. I'm just going to tell you to, if you're that miserable about it, and this is what I've been saying to everybody, get off your ass. Call the Democratic headquarters and see what you can do to help. If you don't want to be out knocking on doors, volunteer to stuff envelopes, just see what you can do. It will ease your anxiety. At least you're doing something. And by the way, we need help. We need people out there actually working instead of saying,
No, it's true.
You got to turn all of this depression and misery into action, please.
It's just that one person after the other, everybody that I listen to, people who do know a lot are
miserable.
Sounding alarm bells left, right, and center. This is something. And then I saw that, I don't want to get into it, but I just, in scrolling through, what the Washington Post or the New York Times said their stories were today. It was nationally and internationally, Donald Trump.
Because Europe is
the air out
Europe,
of the room.
Right.
Terrified. Europe
it's
is
just,
terrified.
Yeah. Yeah, because they can no longer count on the United States policy lasting from one president to another, which was always very important. And it's part of the advantage of separation of the branches. And now we have someone that's not even a branch yanking one branch around and stymieing the others. This is just awful. And the fact that people can sit around and go, yeah, but, you know, the economy, and to which I say, what about the economy?
Okay. I'm turning down my volume.
I'm sorry, but you get my point.
Yeah, I get your point. Anyway, I really got so, I thought, I can't. I just can't. Okay. So I'm...
I can't either. And I'm just telling people, stop calling me for reassurance like I know something. What do I know?
No, you only know that we're in just
I know that we're in trouble.
Danger. In big, big trouble. And every time you turn, there's another thing to be concerned about. It's really something. Well, it doesn't matter. There's just something about, here's a quote from Isaac Newton.
Who said, long ago, you're all doomed.
Sir Isaac Newton. He was an intelligent observer of what was happening. And he said this, I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men.
Yeah.
There it is, Isaac Newton. Yep.
So I got the quote right. We're all doomed.
Well, and so obviously it was ever thus.
Yeah.
Speaking of it was ever thus, the greatest story. This was what saved me. And it was, maybe you saw it. It's these two scientists. I think they're Danish. And they happened to be married to each other. And they ended up doing research on the origin of kissing. And I'm thinking, what? I mean, that
other animals kiss, too. I mean, it's not
just
human behavior.
Right. But as it turns out, obviously, people have tried to document when we're aware, when we have evidence that our ancestors way, 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 way back when actually kissed as well. And it's just there's this funniest information in here that I have to share with you. Because you're right, chimpanzees, bonobos kiss.
Birds.
But if you're talking about lip kissing, I mean,
right.
I know. So we got to figure that it's just some, innate kind of thing, right? Sure seems natural. But it turns out that up until recently, if you were to academically look into the subject, you would have been told that the first known mouth-to-mouth kissing occurred in the Bronze Age. That'd be like 3000 BC. And it said it was found in a genetic study that was a study of herpes variants.
Oh, well, no. Okay. But that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So,
I was trying to figure out how they could trace it. And that would be one way, through disease.
Yeah, exactly. So in this paper that was academic paper that was written, they went into what was known of the history of kissing. And this is, you know, like just a year or so ago. And it said that they pinpointed South Asia as the origin point of kissing. And they said Sanskrit manuscripts, when they were being transcribed, that is the first time anybody mentioned kissing. But here's the thing. If you start looking in Sumeria, Mesopotamia, and that area, you come up with cuneiforms with obvious talk of kissing way before that.
Right. Or pictures, right.
And even pictures and
right.
canoodling couples.
Right.
And
which is where my mind went. Well, there's a cave drawing someplace, you know.
Okay.
There's,
and,
you know.
Well, then, you know, the Kama Sutra.
Right.
The sex manual. That was published around 300 B.C. And it said kissing really spread with the return of Alexander the Great's troops from northern India. What the? I don't know.
Well, they learned a few things from those Italians.
Yes. So here's the deal.
Speaking of things like this, did you hear that a scientist figured out which came first, the chicken or the egg?
No.
But he says it has to be the chicken because the shell of the egg is only made from a hormone that's formed within the hen.
But so where did that chicken come from?
God only knows. He didn't take it that far enough.
Oh, the head spins. Okay. In Sumerian literature, it is clear that couples had intercourse first and only after did they kiss. So kissing was not foreplay, it was after play. I don't know how they know all this, but that's what they say.
It was the thank you, ma'am, after the wham, bam?
I don't know. And they say the Romans, the ancient Romans, had a hierarchy, had words for certain kinds of kisses, different words. So, which makes sense. Cause
a peck on the cheek is different than a passionate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. So they had a, what they say in the article is a hierarchy of kissing. You start with the osculum, that is, you know, a chaste but affectionate, what you just said, a peck on the cheek. That's an osculum. And then you get the basium. And the basium is a closed mouth, lip on lip. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And only after the basium do you get the biggie, the savium or the savium. I don't know how they pronounce it.
Well, they're savoring whatever it is. Yeah,
it is. And that's the full bore, yeah, you know, the thing. So anyway, who knew?
By then you're sucking face. Got it.
That's it, sucking face. That is it. So
phrases that I could live without remembering popping into my head.
Yeah, there is something. Yeah. Speaking of phrases, I was looking on Twitter to see if anything interesting popped up, and sure it did. There was this thing about the origin of the word hush puppy. Which is actually something you eat, right? A hush puppy
It's a potato. It's a potato puff.
Okay, so.
Fried.
Here's, well, here's what this says. And it's mind-blowing.
Oh, it might be made out of cornmeal, too. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Escaping slaves would throw balls of fried cornmeal out.
Like the Israelis escaping Egypt. They made matzah and they made... Shh, puppies.
What?
They made... No, they made hush puppies the
That's
way the Jews
not
made
why
matzah.
They did it, but they didn't. It was for a different purpose.
Oh.
They didn't eat it.
They were weapons. Okay.
Escaping slaves used to throw balls of fried cornmeal out to distract the hound dogs.
Ah. The dogs would stop to eat. Smart.
From tracking them, the dogs would stop barking and start eating. And that's where the word hush puppies.
Very smart.
Well, I know it's very smart. And then it turns out that the fine fact checkers at Twitter appended something to it saying that while this sounds
it's
bullshit. A great story,
it's something not, that Susan could have made
bullshit.
Up.
Yeah, it's not true. Well, and I
it's
thought,
worthy of me. What is
yeah, I thought, damn it, I wanted it to be true. The one time Elon Musk's outfit actually bothers to correct something on their website, on his site, it's something like that, which would do no damage to anybody. God.
Well, so what's the origin?
I didn't look. I was so annoyed that it wasn't true. There were a whole bunch of sites about Google, the origin of hush puppies, because it's
okay.
Not that.
All right. But, and I always get them confused with tater tots anyway. It is cornmeal. Yeah. It's fried cornmeal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway. That was depressing.
Which I always find out when I accidentally order the wrong one in a restaurant.
Okay. Hey, did you see that more Republicans are...
Yes.
Are deaf. Deaf.
That explains it.
It does.
Why they can't
something.
Hear any common sense.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are astonishing. I mean, they really are. I mean, if you're what?
The correlation between being young, and this doesn't mean elderly, natural sort of kind of diminution of hearing. This is in people between the ages of 30 and 54. So it's early onset deafness, and it occurs and prominently more among white, Republican,
rural male
Republican.
White, rural male. So a little more digging finds the answer.
Well, they probably work in noisier professions.
No, well, there's that, but here's the difference. They decided what it is gunfire.
Ah,
they're hunters. They're people who like to target shoot. And that's where the correlation is between white, rural, and people with guns. And it deafens them. What they found is, and these are the actual numbers, this is a true credible study, by the way. Americans who have fired 1,000 rounds or more face three times the rate of hearing loss as those who have never fired a weapon. So if you're firing weapons for fun and or whatever, the odds are you will go deaf a lot sooner than someone like me. And a guy who writes for a hunting publication says if ever there was an epidemic in the hunting community, it would be hearing loss. So there you have it.
You think they'd notice and put some earplugs in, for crying out loud.
And this blew me away. So who has the guns? It is Republicans. And this is mind-blowing to me. In 2022, in the 90s, Democrats were almost as likely to own guns as Republicans. This is how fast we have, gone kaplooey. The 90s, and ain't that long ago.
That's 30 years ago, yes.
Democrats and Republicans, pretty much same levels of gun ownership. Let's go now to 2022. 52% of Republicans have guns. 28% of Democrats. That's a huge.
Well, again, I have no idea how to interpret that statistic because how many Republicans are there and how many registered Republicans are there such that we can compare the actual numbers that entails? I think there's far more registered Democrats than there are registered Republicans. So a 50% of a smaller number might not be that great a disparity. If the Democrats are a sizably number, a greater number, I just don't know how to interpret what that says.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, just saying.
And I do think that there are far more registered Democrats than there are registered Republicans.
Well, I don't think there's as many as there used to be because I think
no one registered. I don't know that I'm registered. You know,
right? People are registered as generally with neither party. Party affiliation is dropping off big time. Okay. Well, after kissing hush puppies and deaf Republicans, where are we heading next? I got to go to the obits because there are two that I've been wanting to share. I mean, one is just such a interesting life that, I mean, what? It's like one thing after another where you think, what? This guy, what? His name is Cy Spiegel. That's his name, S-I, not Simon. He was born, hey, let's call him Cy, S-I. Anyway, he just died. He was 99. And he was among the last surviving American B-17 pilots. And I was talking about those guys the other day because I happened to find myself with two men, both of whose fathers.
As was Bill Schmitz. He was a big fighter pilot in World War II.
Was he? Was he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the death rate was just mind-boggling. Mind-boggling that anyone survived that. So here's one of them that survived. And but he was on a plane that two of the engines got hit. He's trying to he doesn't want to bail out over Germany, which is where he was. And so he managed somehow to get the plane before he totally lost power into Russian-controlled Poland. And he crash-landed it. And by the way, here, listen to the crew. I mean, this is one of the reasons the war forced Americans to be with other Americans they would otherwise not be with. You know, if you went into the military, I know our father used to talk about it. I mean, he ended up with people. He never would have.
And they with him. Yes.
So here is Cy Spiegel. He's the pilot. And the crew consisted of one other Jew. So there were two Jews in the crew, which is amazing to me. And five Catholics, a Mormon, and a criminal who had been given a choice of going to jail or joining up.
Sounds like a bad bar joke. Yeah.
Right. Two Jews, five Catholics, a Mormon, and a criminal.
Walk into a bar. Right.
Right, right. So, I mean, right there, I'm thinking, oh, geez, I mean, there's something wonderful about that, but it gets better. So there they are, this, you know, odd crew, and they're stuck in Soviet-controlled Poland.
Yeah, but they all survived the crash.
They did. It didn't, well, he managed, he was a hell of a pilot. He put the plane down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were stuck there for weeks. And then Cy improvised a daring escape. Turns out there was another plane that had crashed nearby. And what they did is they used parts of
They ponied together a plane, yeah.
They jury-rigged a plane out of the two crashed ones and got it into the air. Unbelievably, got it into the air and made their way to an American base in Italy. I mean, that should be a movie.
Yeah, it sure should.
So anyway, he gets home to the U.S. and he wanted to be a pilot. He wanted to be a commercial pilot. And so he applied. And here's the quote from Cy in his obit. They were blatant about it. It wasn't that they gave you some excuse. They just told
you. He was Jewish, yeah.
We don't hire Jews. Yeah. Okay. So there goes that dream. He had some background in as a machinist. So he tried to get jobs as a machinist, but kept finding trouble. Because it turns out that he had a role as an organizer for the United Electrical Workers Union, which was branded as a communist, riddled with commies.
Well, it's a union.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that he did join, right after the war, Pete Seeger's the folk artist, folk song guy, he joined Pete Seeger's Good Neighbor Chorus and attended a camp called Camp Unity. This is another commie place. It's a flat-out communist-affiliated summer camp in Wingdale, New York, where he met this Japanese girl, Motoko Ikada, and she had been with her parents imprisoned by the U.S. government during the war, an internment camp in Wyoming. Right. So Cy Spiegel, the Jew, couldn't be the pilot anymore because he was a Jew, at this commie Pete Seeger camp, meets the love of his life, this Japanese woman, and they married. He later said of her, she predeceased him by 20 years, but they were married for 50 years. He said, Motoko was better at Jewish food than my mother ever was. She could cook in any language. So, none of this is to why he gets this obit in the New York Times. Here's the headline. Cy Spiegel, 99, hero in war, who created Christmas trees. And now the rest of the story. He finally lands a job at something called the American Brush Machinery Company in Mount Vernon, New York.
Oh, he made the first fake Christmas trees.
Well, he didn't make the first. It turns out this place and others had already started, because artificial Christmas trees had been manufactured for decades, and they were made out of the same animal hair bristles used for toilet brushes.
Of course.
No.
Anybody could have told you that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and then they were made from aluminum and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, this place didn't do well in the Christmas tree biz. But Cy, he started looking at the machinery that they had used to make these things. And within 3 years, he had patented all kinds of new production techniques, founded something called the Hudson Valley Tree Company, and was mass producing 80,000 trees a year, employing 800 people, and had made millions and millions and millions of dollars.
You know, it's I always find it so fascinating how Jewish people have made such a living off of Christmas. I mean, all the most famous of all the Christmas songs are written by Jewish composers.
Jews often.
And and here's the guy making the Christmas tree a Jew.
Right. And it says that when he and his wife raised their children, they celebrated the Jewish holidays, but always had a Christmas tree.
Of course.
And he said, look, they're pagan symbols.
Right.
And my kids liked them.
Well, exactly. I mean, we used to decorate our tree with dreidels and, you know, stars. It is a pagan symbol. It's a, you know, winter solstice sort of thing. It's just, you know, it's like poinsettias. Like, why can't I have a poinsettia? It wasn't born a Christian plant.
I'm, you know, old school. I disapprove.
I'm not going to cede whole botanical groups to a certain religion and be deprived of it. Sorry.
Well, but it's not a matter of that. It's a matter of cutting down a glorious conifer and bringing it into your house.
I absolutely agree with you. That's why Cy made fake ones.
So anyway, that was one of the obits. Isn't that a great sort of life?
I did tell you that my 2-year-old granddaughter wanted to know what happened to the Christmas tree, right?
No. What? It ends up being thrown out in the garbage.
Right. She saw with horror one day that the tree was gone and asked her mother what happened to the tree. And her mother explains, well, the tree was living. Then we cut it down. And it can only live so long, and then it dies. And my granddaughter looks at her, you know, gravely, and then says, oh, so the Christmas tree is now with, and she starts listing every dead
all
person that she knows, including and ending with Ernie.
And your dog,
Yeah.
Well, she's trying to understand.
She's got
that.
A file labeled dead things in her little 2-year-old brain.
Aw. Well, good for her.
Well, yeah, you know, she's learning consequences, that's for sure.
So, are you ready for one more obit?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll stop with
granddaughter's
story.
No, don't be sorry. No. I loved it. This is a woman, died at the age of 90. Her name is Inger McCabe Elliott. And I don't even know where to start with this one. Something happened to her.
Well, there's a whole history in her names, but anyway, you know.
Yeah. But there's a whole history. Something happened to her that you can't believe. And in fact, was made into first a play and then into a movie. It's one of, you know, like when we said about size thing, geez, you should make a movie out of that. Well, here's somebody who actually did live something, and yeah, they made a play and then a movie. Here's what happened. This is 1983. She's married to a top editor at Newsweek magazine. Oh, he was. At the time, he was the dean of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Okay? That's who she's married to. And she is at home at their New York home in the city, and she gets a phone call. And there's a young man on the line, and he introduced himself as David Poitier. He said, "I'm a friend of your daughter's, Carrie, and I'm so sorry to be bothering you, but I got mugged. I lost all my money. I lost the term paper I was writing about the criminal justice system. Can you just put me up for the night?" He said, "My dad will be here." Exactly. Yeah. "My dad will be here tomorrow. And he's coming in to direct scenes for the film version of the Broadway musical Dreamgirls, and he will be here." And she is just charmed by this guy. And she says, "Of course, you come right over. You come right over." And they gave him money. They gave him some clothes.
Uh-huh.
He said to Inger McCabe Elliott, "Thank you so much for this, and could you wake me in the morning so that I can, you know, go jogging?" Obviously, they had tried to reach their daughter, telling her that her friend was at their house.
Right.
They never got through to the daughter.
Right.
And the next morning, Inger McCabe Elliott knocked on the door where she had placed this so-called David Poitier. And she found him in bed with a man that he had smuggled into the apartment. And upon seeing her, he languidly rolls over and says, "This is Malcolm Forbes' nephew who was locked out of his house."
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? I mean, a scam like that. First of all, you got to ask, what is that guy? I mean, the gall, you could say even courage to, like, feel so comfortable to do that and to figure that these, well.
Yeah, I would be thinking, how can I lock them in that room while I call the police?
Right. Well, her husband, the dean of the journalism school, as she said, threw him out by the scruff of the neck. And as he was being thrown out, he asked to borrow $50 to buy flowers. By the way, Sidney Poitier had no sons. He had six daughters. He had no involvement in Dreamgirls.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm going, what?
Well, the thing is,
No, I mean,
these are not people who would be easily, you know, conned. That's how smooth this guy was.
Right.
And I'm looking at a picture of him. He's handsome as hell. And they were totally taken by him and how well-spoken he was. So listen, she's so freaked by this. She calls her best friend. And the best friend's husband was the head of the New York Public Television station. So these are all these people up at the, you know, higher levels.
Higher levels of media, various forms of media, yes.
And she says to her friend, Lee, my God, the craziest thing just happened. You will not believe this.
And that happened to them, too.
The night before,
uh-huh.
He had been at her friend's home, had also stayed overnight. What are the odds of that?
Was Malcolm Forbes' son there, too?
No, I don't say nephew. No, nephew. I don't know. Well, they didn't see him. I don't know. So here's how the hell does this happen? Well, it turns out that this guy, whose real name is David Hampton, had found an address book, or it appears he had stolen an address book from a student at Connecticut College. That student had attended Phillips Academy in Andover.
Yeah, where only the best people send their kids.
That's right, where these two families sent their kids.
That's why I wanted my kids to go to public school for security.
So he was arrested and charged with burglary and criminal impersonation. He pled guilty to some lesser charge, and he did serve 21 months in prison. Meanwhile, the Inger and her husband end up, I forget where they were, but they told this story to a guy who wrote plays, Don Guare. And he thought it was an extraordinary story, of course. And
so G-U-A-R-R-E, I know him.
Yeah. So he ended up 5 or 10 years later, he wrote a play based on this called 6 Degrees of Separation.
Of Separation. Well, that's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was later made into a movie. Will Smith played.
Right.
The guy.
Right. But it happens all the time. I mean, what's her name that just got out of jail for living for a couple of years as a high life in all over Europe and the United States, convincing people that she was someone who she wasn't.
Oh, that. Yeah.
And they made a show about her, too.
Right. I'm blanking on the name of that show, but yeah, she was supposedly an heiress. Right? She had nothing. She was just extraordinary. The thing about these people that do that, like she did and like this guy did, is, you know, the odds of them being caught were always pretty damn high.
Which is why they get away with it, because the behavior is so brazen that you believe them. Who would do that?
But all it would take is her having gotten through to her daughter.
That's right.
Or the other family.
Didn't. And what's the worst that happens? What's the worst that happens? You throw them out and you don't tell a soul because you're humiliated, like her friends did.
Right. You don't tell because you look like an idiot.
Right.
Yeah. So,
And I just want to say the chances of that happening to me would be very high. just because I believe people, you know.
I don't like not, but yeah.
I don't like leading with distrust.
I don't either. So, you know, and then you'd miss out on having this wonderful story.
Yeah, and right. Yeah, but, worst case, you're murdered, of course. But if, short of murdered,
right. That's the worst case. Yeah.
Short of murdered or robbed of everything you hold dear, you know, or, you know, something along those lines. Yeah, it's one hell of a good story, as 7 degrees of separation proves.
So the guy in question, his picture is in the obit, was how I can see him. And he has a picture where he's standing next to the whatever you call it, a graphic advertisement for 6 degrees of separation on Broadway. And he's posed next to a depiction of himself on the poster. And he later sued.
I was waiting for this part of the story. Hey, where's my cut?
Yeah. He sued the playwright, he sued Lincoln Center Theater, and a whole bunch of other people he could think of for $100 million in damages for using his life. And
that falls down because it was also all the other people's lives.
It was he lost that suit.
Yeah.
He was dead of AIDS at 39.
Well, that, folks, is what you call a real dyed-in-the-wool sociopath.
Yeah.
And you have to be such to be able to perform so guilelessly.
It's just extraordinary. It's really extraordinary to me. Wow. I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men.
And women.
And women.
Turns out we're every bit as awful.
Oh, yeah. And I don't, let's see. Oh, this was just a letter to the editor, which, and this is more serious, coming on that latest bizarre shooting. The woman at the church who brought her kid along.
Right. Well, sure. Why not? It's hard to find a babysitter, so just bring him to your afternoon shooting.
Unbelievable. Yeah, poor child. I guess he's not going to make it. I don't know. Whatever.
He got shot. Yeah, I don't know if he. I don't
yeah.
Condition.
Yeah. Well, he's in critical condition. And what? He's lost. I don't know. So, you know, if we all had a picture in our heads of who these mass killers are, and they're white men, right?
Usually, yeah.
So this is the first woman I know of, isn't it? I can't think of a woman.
Well, mass shooter attempt, I think, yes. I mean, there have been women serial killers and stuff, but which is also rare.
Yes, there have been. Yeah, but rare.
But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And so, of course, they go and they find that she has all these anti-Semitic screeds. Turns out she was married to a Jew. Obviously insane. Why did she go shoot? No, they'll never know.
Yeah, why would you go shoot
a bunch of Christians?
Right.
If you're an anti-Semite, why didn't you go to a...
Who's married to a Jew?
Yeah, don't understand it, any of it. Anyway, why did I bring that up? Oh, so often what, you know, Republicans say is, you know, it's mental illness. And then, of course, they don't fund anything for
no
treatment.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, it's like the border. And Johnson just this morning was saying, listen, we can't pass that defense bill because we said we wouldn't do anything until we did the border. And when you look at him cross-eyed and said, well, you refused to do anything about the border. So, it's just amazing.
Well, they're relying on all the deaf Republicans.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
Un-effing believable. So it's mental illness. You talk about homelessness and they'll say it's mental illness, it's drugs, it's always, you know, these things. And I happened to read a letter that was written to the New Yorker about an article they had on Portland, Oregon's efforts to get a handle on the homeless and drug usage and all that through, making sure that they weren't dying, just helping them if they were addicted to be able at least to do it without dying.
Yeah, right. Access services, right.
Right. And this, you know, Republicans think that's awful.
Right.
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 And
like
so
a methadone clinic kind of thing or a needle exchange sort of thing.
Exactly. This is, you're aiding and abetting these horrible people. Right. So some guy writes, well, I'll tell you who it is. His name is Michael Botticelli. And he writes a letter about the article. And he gives his, he makes clear that he has reason to have a pretty good understanding of these issues. He says, after 35 years in recovery myself and a life spent trying to create pathways out of addiction for others, including as the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy under President Obama. So that's who's writing this. And here's what
he's credentialed, right?
Totally. He says, reading this article about drug decriminalization efforts in Oregon, I was reminded that addiction treatment is the only area of healthcare in which we consider saving someone's life to be an unacceptable outcome.
Exactly.
I mean, think of that. Think of that. He says, as a society, we would find it morally repugnant to withhold care from anyone with a chronic or life-threatening medical condition.
Well, no, that's no longer true because they do it to women all the time.
Okay, well, simply because they didn't adhere completely to their treatment. Well, that's, yes, okay, yeah. As a society, yes, for a pregnant woman, no, we can let her die too.
Right.
So he ends his letter with this. And I really took me, you know, it's just amazing. I always say we are the cruelest of societies. And he says this, I can only conclude that Americans fundamentally believe that people who suffer from addiction are morally flawed and somehow don't deserve the help we can give them. And that's right. We're a punitive, cruel people. You know, I've been going to downtown recently, and I've been actually going to City Paper, to the offices of City Paper. And in order to go there, when I pull off the, you know, the highway, the parkway, I get off at the first major downtown exit, which is Grant Street, where all the courts are and City Hall and yada, yada, yada. And the minute you get off there, you are in, I was stunned because I hadn't been down there in some time. There are cities of homeless people.
Yeah, tent cities. Yeah.
Tents on any place where there's a little spot where there's some grass next to a building and some landscaping, and there are tents right up against each other, you know, tent, and there's even a black, you know, charcoal grill outside of one. I make a turn, and I'm going like along the river, and tents, and I'm thinking, what kind of a country? We are supposedly the richest nation. What kind of a country?
Well, somehow, Lynn, you know, in a lot of cases, that's not just homeless. That's the immigrants that are being bused to cities and dropped. I mean, if you drive around Chicago in any park, you've got that. And a part of it's put up with the city. We thank God for, I don't really mean this, climate change, because Chicago has been sort of spring like for all but 10 days, you know. Those around here, that's 10, 20, 30,000 migrants.
Well, that's not the issue here. That is not happening here.
Okay.
What is wrong with us that we don't take care of each other?
Well, also what's wrong with us that we don't take all of that empty office space, which is never refilled since the pandemic, and turn it into housing? I mean, we need the housing. Every major city needs the housing.
And they don't need
the offices.
Right. And a lot of homeless people are people who finally could not find a place with their they could afford to live in. And that's part of gentrifiers and hedge funds buying up.
It is hedge funds buying up affordable single family housing for rentals and then making them which ups the housing costs and ups the rental market. So, excuse me for saying such, but there ought to be a law.
Yeah. Well,
and there used to be laws. And when people look back fondly on what things were like long ago, I'm going to tell you what the difference was. Regulations.
Yeah.
Enforced regulations and restraint on free enterprise and capitalism.
Right.
Because unfettered, it ain't good for the general populace.
Ugly. It is ugly. And
when the only motive is profit, there are no plugs in the bolts in the airplanes. It affects people.
Yeah. Well, Suze,
on that cheery note.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. We did pretty good there, right?
Yes. And Cy, may your name be a blessed memory. And what was her and McNeil?
McCabe Elliott. Yeah. Two great stories.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I'm sure they've accomplished it. Their names will be of blessed memory.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's it for us.
Yeah.
Are you heading anywhere?
I am. I was almost
heading
done
north.
Packing before I called you, and I'm going to finish
head
up and head up north.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Suze.
Okay. Talk soon.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I just want to say thank you for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow. I don't have anywhere else to go.
Lynn Cullen Live, Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and archived at pghcitypaper.com. The opinions expressed on Lynn Cullen Live are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of Pittsburgh City Paper or its advertisers.